friends, you've heard the title, Love is a Garden. So this telecast has something to do about love. It will touch maybe on the fine points of love, particularly married love. And it reminds one of extremes. One extreme about marriage is the story of Adam out walking in the garden, out walking after the fall of the Garden of Paradise. He had his two boys with him, one on either side. And they passed by the wreck and ruin of the beautiful Garden of Paradise. And Adam looked in, pulled the boys to himself. He says, "Boys, that's where your mother ate us out of house and home." On that bad side of it, too, is the story of the wife who went in to get a collar for her husband. And the clerk said, "What size?" She said, "About that size." You didn't get that, did you? And then on the more pleasing aspect of marriage, President Harding was once asked, at what age do you think women are most beautiful? He said, "The age of my wife." Now, why do we say love is a garden? Well, after all, the whole love story of the human race began in the garden. Their love was at its peak, and then it went into decline. And then finally, love was reaffirmed again in the garden. Because the gospel says, and the place where they crucified him was a garden, where the flowers seemed to be dead, and yet in the springtime, there was a resurrection. But if it be a garden, we're going to take some of the stages of love in terms of a garden. Now, before one can be married, or let us say, before you can plant a garden, you have to get a flower catalog. And they're always very ornate, you know. And you look through the flower catalog for the kind of flower that you want. And that equals courtship, doesn't it? Where a man seeks a lady and the lady seeks the man. Now, there are all kinds of flowers in this garden. Roses, lilies, humble violets, sunflowers, carnations. One can have only one. But one courts this person or that. And it is interesting to note that in this courtship, very often a girl will choose a man at the age of 17, which she would not choose generally at 19. And very often, the man that you would choose at 19 is not the man she would choose at 21. We have actually, in the United States, the longest the longest juvenile period of any country in the world. Maybe it's because we're wealthy and we're comfortable. And it takes a long, long time to grow up. I knew of an Irish couple that had been courting for years, 20 years or more. And she said to him, "Don't you think that we really ought to be getting married?" And he said, "Ah, glory be to God who'd be having either of us." And then there was Lincoln. Lincoln, courted Mary Todd. And yet he was not so sure about it. 5 days before, he had doubts. And 5 days after marriage, he wrote to a friend of his. Nothing new, except I've been married, which to me is a profound wonder. Charles Dickens, who did not choose a particularly good flower, wrote once to the young lady whom he was courting. He said, "If during this period that you love me, you really should seek to be at your best. But if you have such violent outbursts of temper, what will it be later on?" So there's some indication of, as one looks through this catalog of flowers, all the girls and all the boys that are available, there was always some embarrassment of choice, but I really believe, not in every instance, but in some, there is such a thing as love at first sight. I wonder if every one of us who is about to become engaged does not have a picture of the girl, for example, he wants to marry, the man. And if the girl does not have a picture of the ideal. Is not that true about music? We hear music for the first time, and we like it or we dislike it. Why is that? It's because the music that we love is the music we already have in our own heart. There's a certain tempo, flow, rhythm about our lives. And certain people fit into that. And this ideal image that we carry about is made up of dreams, of hopes, experiences, thoughts and longings. And I never saw it better fulfilled than a friend of mine, a Swiss gentleman, who had a picture in his home that he noticed when he was about 4 or 5 years of age. And looking at that picture one day, he said to his mother, "Someday, Mother, I'm going to marry a girl that looks exactly like that." Now, this was in Switzerland. And then as he went on, that is to say, became older, he repeated the words to his mother. He told me about the story. I witnessed his marriage to his wife. And do you know that that picture is almost a painting of his wife? It's now hanging in their home. He really had an ideal love. So therefore, the courtship is like the flower, picking the flower before you begin to make your garden. And then afterwards comes the choosing of the one flower. And the choosing of the one flower, of course, is the proposal. Now, every proposal is an affirmation of love. And every affirmation of love is a negation of love. But the mere fact that you choose one, you negate all others. And a garden is just precisely that. A garden is a setting aside of a certain plot of earth, fencing it in, putting limits to it, shutting off a wilderness in order that one might cultivate the particular flower that one loves. In proposals, there are very few that are ever written out. And rightly so, because proposal has to come from the heart. Of all the proposals that I have ever heard about, the most beautiful of all was the proposal of G.K. Chesterton. That wonderful English essayist, and incidentally, for those of you who want to cultivate a style, you can do little better than imitate Chesterton. Here is his proposal. I have written it out. There are four lamps of thanksgiving always before me. The first is my creation out of the same earth with such a woman as you. The second is that I have not, with all my faults, gone after strange women. You cannot think how a man's self-restraint is rewarded in this. The third is that I have tried to love everything alive, a dim preparation for loving you. And the fourth, no words can express this. Here ends my previous existence. Take it. It led me to you. And after the choosing, two O's in choosing. How many noticed that? All of you noticed it. Yes. I didn't do this purposely, but that's always one way to get attention. I could have said, well, you see, we're all going to sleep. I noticed that, and I just wanted to see if you were awake. But you did. You were quite awake. Choosing. That's the choosing of the flower. And the next is the marriage. And the marriage is the planting of the garden. After one has looked at all the flowers, oh yes, apropos of courtship, I might tell you too. I will tell you this to make up for misspelling choosing. This young man confided to a friend of his. He said, she's the most wonderful girl in the world. And I proposed to her, and she refused. All his friends said, don't be downhearted. After all, when a woman says no, she sometimes means yes. But he said, she didn't say no. She said, phooey. I heard of one Marine who was consoling another who had lost his best girl, or at any rate, he tried to marry her, and she refused. Ah, he says, remember, he says, girls are all 82% water. Well, it's the 18, maybe, that makes the difference. So the planting of the garden, after the flower has been chosen uniquely out of the catalog, then there comes the union of the flower and the garden, the planting of the seed. And here there is something more than just a transient experience. I believe that I told you in a previous telecast that Scripture never speaks of marriage in terms of sex. It speaks of it in terms of knowing.
Lot's daughters knew not man. Adam knew Eve, and she conceived. Then the Blessed Mother said to the angel, "How shall this be? I know not man." Interesting, isn't it, that it should speak of it in terms of knowledge? And why? Well, because there are certain things that can be known in their depth, such as death itself. That's something you have to experience to know what it is. Until we die, we don't know what it's like. Another is the experience of life. No young person can give any judgment at all about what life is as it's gone through its various phases. And the union of husband and wife is another. I know you. I know myself. A borderline has been crossed. And one can never put oneself back again into the state of innocence, into the state of not knowing. It's forever there. Certain things we can make up for. For example, if I steal, I can return that which is stolen and ask for pardon. But here's something that cannot be stolen, returned after it is stolen. It's registered. And that is why it takes a constant atmosphere of love to maintain this growth in knowledge. That's why marriage is permanent. Constantly sounding the mystery of the other person. Mystery of body, the mystery of soul, the mystery of a woman, the mystery of a man, mothercraft, fathercraft, and all that love means. And then finally, there are the seasons. The seasons are the various trials that come in the course of life. The flowers have to withstand inclement weather. Too little sunshine, too much sunshine. And so life has its seasons too. Love has its springtime, its summer, its bearing of children, fruit, autumn. It also has its winter. And to love through all the seasons is a great joy. And here I'm going to read for you perhaps a poem that you know. Elizabeth Barrett Browning's poem to her husband. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can. We're feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need, by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with the love I seem to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life. And if God choose, shall but love thee better
after death.
Such are the seasons where at first the body leads the soul, and later on it is the soul that leads the body. Now there is the last point of all. One thing we have not found in our garden is something invisible. The invisible forces which work on a garden. Yes, here's the growth of this rose or lily, whatever it happens to be. But do you explain its growth simply by the planting of the seed and by the earth? Think of the tremendous invisible forces. The atmosphere. The sun. The dew, the hidden chemicals. Actually, more of them go into the developing of this rose or this lily than does the earth, than anything you can touch. And so there's something unseen and invisible in all love. And that's the source of love itself, which is God. I just cannot conceive a young man being in love and not loving God. I can't conceive it. This is the invisible force that pulls them on. That's why they speak of our love. Something bigger and better than just your love and mine. It's not the sum of two. Something bigger than both of us, as they say. Certainly there are ecstasies. But if human flesh can give it, then whence does it come? And so may couples say, in this beautiful ecstasy of love, if the human heart can so thrill me, what must be the heart of God? If the spark is so bright, what must be the flame?